Last week, I mentioned to you Hillman Ury, how Hillman was the chairman of the board of the first little country church I went to back when I was 19 years old. Richards, Texas, small town of about 200 people. When I got there, Marsh and I were engaged. We would be married in about 6 or 7 months. But we arrived and Hillman was there to give us the key to the parsonage and begin moving things in. He kind of helped us find our way around and to see the church. As I say, he was the chairman of the board and was just such a nice man. We soon became fast friends. And I finally said to Hillman, I said, you know, I'd like you to be my associate pastor. Now, this was an official kind of thing, but he agreed and he was excited about it. And so Hillman began reading the scripture on Sunday morning. He began leading the singing. He would lead in the responsive readings. We just started doing all kinds of things together. We needed to paint the church. And so, you know, I'm 19 years old. He's in his mid-60s. We're climbing ladders and we're painting two-story hallways and doing all kinds of things. And then right off the bat, I said, Hillman, we need to air condition this church. I mean, this was an old little country church. You raised the windows on Sunday morning. The birds would fly through. I mean, you hear the dogs howling and the horns blowing. And as from Houston, a city boy, I said, we're going to air condition this church. We got that done. We put in central air. He and I just worked on all kinds of projects together, and we had such a good time. And then one day I had a member of the church come and say, Bob, we need to take up a love offering. There's a family moving to town, and the husband needs a quadruple bypass. The wife doesn't have a job. They have several children. They need our help. And I said, that sounds like the right thing to do. All right, next week we'll take up a love offering. And I stood up on Sunday morning and said, we're going to take up a love offering next Sunday. And I told them the story, and then when church was over, I went back over to the parsonage, and Hillman was waiting for me. And Hillman said, Bob, I think this is a bad idea. I don't want us to do this. You don't know this family. They're bad people. He said, I lived here for a long time. I used to have a business here. These people owed me money. They didn't pay. I went out to go see them. They told me, get off my property or I will call the police. They left town. They never did pay me. No, I'm telling you, these are bad people. I said, Hillman, I am so sorry. I had no idea. I had no idea. That I didn't know this happened to you. I didn't know this about them. I thought for a moment, and then I said, but you know, the children, they're not responsible for any of this. I really feel like we still need to go ahead and do this to help the family. Well, you need to know that I'm against it, and I'm not going to be a part of it. And I said, I got it. I got it. I understand that, and I understand. I'm not going to stop you. Okay. And he left. I got to tell you, that was one of the hardest things that I have ever done, was to say to this man who was mentoring me and blessing me and loving me, we're going to do this, even though you don't want us to. So next Sunday we got to church and I stood up and I talked about the family and said we're going to take up a love offering, and we passed the plates and we collected the offering, and when church was over I took the money back over to the parsonage to count so I could give it to Miss Lenorman and she could write a check for me to take to the family that afternoon. And I started going through the offering, and then I came across the biggest check that anyone would give that morning to help this family, and it was from Hillman Ury. And I just sat there and looked at that check, 19 years old, and thought, this is a saint in the church. It's what it means to be the church. That here is a man who was harmed by these other people, the man whom they still owed money, the man who was treated poorly, and he gives the largest gift to help them of anybody? I've never forgotten it. I know that forgiving is hard. But I also know that we are all human and we're all going to hurt each other. And if we can't ever forgive, then we will not have long-term relationships. We will not have family. We will not have church. I think that's what was motivating Paul this morning in his letter to the Colossians. Now, I told you last week about Thessalonica. Thessalonica was a big town. I mean, it was a big city. It was the second largest city in Greece in Paul's day, and it's still the second largest city in Greece to this day. It's now called Thessaloniki. It's a port city, this huge place. It has this incredible history. Well, Colossae, it was not the same way. It was a smaller town right on a main road on the way to Ephesus. Trade went through there. Paul did not start the church, but Paul did pass through and met the people and cared about them, and so he would write a letter to them. We believe it was about 10 years after he wrote the letter to the Thessalonians. But Paul is now writing to the Colossians. And as he writes to them, I like the fact that he says, if one has a complaint against another, forgive each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so also you must forgive. As I was reading that, I couldn't help but think, you know, I've heard this in Paul over and over again. If you go back and look at Paul's letter to the Romans, he says, live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty. Repay no one evil for evil. If possible, so far as it depends upon you, live peaceably with all. He writes to the church in Corinth, all this is from God, who through Christ reconciled himself to us and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. He writes to the Ephesians, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God and Christ forgave you. And then he writes to the Colossians, if one has a complaint against another, forgive each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. It's not just to the Colossians, it is to all the churches that Paul keeps writing, and there is a recurring theme, message, over and over again, because Paul knows if we're going to be the church, if this new small church is to survive, then we have to live in a spirit of forgiveness. As Christ has forgiven you, then you are called to forgive one another. For without forgiveness, there will be no family of faith. But forgiveness is hard. Three things that I want us to think about this morning. First of all, we need to ask ourselves, what is forgiveness? I think sometimes the reason you and I find it hard to forgive is because when we think about forgiving, what we think about is we're saying to someone, what you did does not matter. What you did was not important. I'm just going to forget it, forgive, it doesn't matter. It was not important. And when somebody has wronged you, when somebody has hurt you, that doesn't feel good. But I don't think that's forgiveness. Forgiveness is not about just saying you're going to forget and what you did doesn't matter. It's about saying from a position of strength, a position of power, you say, I am going to give up the right to demand justice. I give up the right to demand what is fair. I give up the right to get even. What you did matters. What you did hurt me. But out of a place of power, I choose to give up the right to get even. That's still hard to do. I'm sure some of you have seen recently in the news about Leslie Van Houten. What a fascinating story. It was just a couple of weeks ago. That name should ring a bell. Leslie Van Houten, back in 1969, she is a part of the Charles Manson gang. The summer of 69, the summer of love, it all ended in a horrible way with lots of murders out in California. Charles Manson had brought together a group of people, had just basically kind of brainwashed them and said, we're going to start a revolution and we got to go out and commit all kinds of murders. And so they went and murdered Sharon Tate, who was a real budding actress doing super. She was 8 months pregnant. They murdered her and four of her friends. And then they murdered the LaBiancas, a husband and wife who had done very well in the cleaning business. It turned out that Leslie was 19 years old, the youngest person in the Manson gang. She'd been a homecoming queen. She used to sing in the church choir. Her mom and dad got divorced. Her world kind of started spinning out of control. She felt guilty. She blamed herself. She started getting mixed up and then doing drugs. And before she knew it, she fell in with Manson and he said, we need to go kill. And she did. Stabbed Miss LaBianca 14 times. The murders were brutal. They were all captured in 1969. By 1972, they had been brought to trial and they were all sentenced to death. She'd have been the youngest person ever put to death in California. But in the end, California declared the death penalty unconstitutional and banned the death penalty. And so all of them were automatically given a life sentence. Leslie was in prison. She'd been there for several years when she really had a conversion experience. She became a Christian. She started going to Bible studies. She started teaching Bible studies, helping other prisoners. Almost 47 years has gone by. 47 years. 47 years, she has nothing on her record for doing anything wrong through that 47 years. In fact, she's been a model prisoner. She's gotten a bachelor's degree. She's earned a master's degree. She does help so many people in prison. She says that she is a Christian, a person of faith. She has been interviewed by all kinds of professionals and counselors who say she appears to truly have had a conversion experience, seems to have turned. She's come up for parole 19 times. And every time she comes up for parole, she comes before the parole board. They come in, they sit down, they say, we're going to call this meeting to order. Parole denied. The crimes were so heinous we can never forget. And they get up and take her back to jail for another 2 years. But just a few weeks ago, on the 20th time, they came in to have board hearing and now they talk for 5 hours. And in the end, the parole board granted her parole at 66 years old. She's been there for almost 47 years. She still doesn't have parole. She still isn't free. Now it goes to the governor, and the governor gets to decide, does he sign it and give her parole, or does he deny it, and she stays in prison. And it has sparked a fascinating debate around our country of everybody asking, should she be paroled or not? Are there some crimes that are so horrible, no, you never get parole? Or do you believe someone can change and should be forgiven? Well, it sparked a debate. It is not an easy one on what to do. I cannot imagine how everyone must feel. But I saw an interview with a lady, Deborah Tate. She was Sharon Tate's sister, the actress who was killed. She was 17 years old when her sister died. And I saw her being interviewed. She looked so sad. And it was so painful. And she explained that she has been to every parole hearing of every member of the Manson gang for 47 years to argue against parole for any of them. And The interviewer asked her, said, well, do you believe that people can change? Do you believe that Leslie has changed? And she said, no, she is a monster. She is a horrible person. If she is set free, she would commit this kind of crime all over again. We must keep her in prison. And then the commentator said, I know that Leslie was given a life sentence, but it sounds to me like she wasn't the only one to get a life sentence. And Deborah said, oh, you're right, you're right. Ever since the murders, we've never been the same. We've never been able to pull it together. It has not been a good thing. We had a life sentence as well. I felt her pain. And I also felt so sad. I'm not sure that having spent a life just full of anger and hatred over what had happened was the best way to spend 47 years. Two people received a life sentence. How hard that has been. It seems that it's only through forgiveness that you can ever be set free. Which leads to the second thing. Maybe if forgiveness is easier, it is easier to forgive others when we first start by looking at ourselves. It's easier to forgive others when we first start looking at ourselves. You know, that's why Paul said, it is because Christ has forgiven you that we've been called to forgive. Because we have been forgiven, we are called to this ministry of reconciliation, of forgiving. It's really building very much on Jesus' example when Jesus had the woman who was caught in the act of adultery brought before Jesus and thrown into the dirt, and they had her surrounded with stones to stone her. And Jesus waited for a while and finally said, let him who hath no sin cast the first stone. And it said, starting with the eldest, you see, we've had a longer time to sin, starting with the eldest, they all dropped their stones and went away. No, when you and I get honest and stand before God and look at our own lives, and when we see our own self standing in need of God's grace, it's then easier to offer grace to others. Because not all the things that happen to us are at the level of a Leslie Van Houten. No, most things are far smaller. And yet how much of our lives do we live holding that kind of grudge and anger and hatred towards someone else? Maybe if we start with ourselves. You know, John Newton was a fascinating man. He was born in 1725, born in England. His mother died when he was 2 years old. And he really had a difficult time growing up. I mean, he was just one of these children, especially without his mom, always getting into trouble. And so to help straighten him out, his father got him enlisted at 12 years old in the British Navy. Now that's going to straighten out a kid. The British Navy in the 1700s and you're 12 years old and made a cabin boy? He continued to be getting into trouble. He just was able to ratchet it up a few notches, struggled, but he did show incredible leadership. And in the end, at 25 years old, he was made captain of a ship, a slave ship. And so what he would do is he would start at Liverpool and take the ship and bring on goods, sail down to Africa. There he would deliver the goods. They would bring on the slaves, putting them down there in the base of the ship, side by side, cramming as many as they could in. And there they would lay there all the way to the other side of the ocean. And whichever ones were alive, they brought off and then they sold them. And then they'd load up with more cargo and then sail back to England. And that's what he would do. Now, John was a prolific writer. He kept a very detailed diary. He wrote lots of letters. And it's really because the copy we have of his diaries and letters that we really have a first-hand account of what truly slave ships were like and the slave trade was like in those days. Well, he's doing that trip after trip, And then on one trip, he set sail from Liverpool down towards Africa, and they get caught in a storm. And the wind is screaming, and the waves are crashing onto the boat, and it finally is looking like the period that the boat is going to sink, and everybody knows they're going to die. And John finds himself on deck staring out into the waves, and the wind is screaming, and suddenly he hollers, "Lord, have mercy on us! Save us!" And then he thought, goodness gracious, where'd that come from? He was not religious. He didn't believe in the Lord. No, it so shocked him in the middle of the storm, he turned around and went down to his cabin. Then he began to write in his diary about it. Why did my soul cry unto the Lord, "Save us, have mercy on us"? And he thought, maybe God is speaking to my soul. Maybe there is a God. It started him on a spiritual pilgrimage over the next 2 years as he began to listen more and think more and even begin to pray. And at the end of 2 years, John suddenly walked away from his commission there as a captain and felt that God was calling him to be an Anglican priest. He went back to seminary. He became ordained as an Anglican priest. And in 1760, he was sent to Olney there in England. Now remember, this was the time of John and Charles Wesley in England. And they were moving through England and saying, you need to do more than go to church on Sunday. You need to go to Bible studies. You need to come together and worship during the middle of the week. And so John Newton believed the same thing needed to be happening. And so even though he was Anglican, he kind of followed the lead of the Methodist and started getting them together during the week for Bible study and worship and singing. He wrote 347 hymns himself to help his people to sing. And so it was, we believe, in 1779 that he would write a song that was his own spiritual autobiography. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see." Go back and read the hymn. It truly is a discussion of his own life and his own struggles. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me." We first find that song showing up in the United States in 1835. Showed up in a hymnal. But then it starts showing up in every hymnal of regardless of the denomination from then on, all the way up to today. You know, in the 1960s and 70s, which were so tumultuous in our country, it was fascinating. You would have all these singers, these secular singers, at these rock concerts, and then somebody would break into singing "Amazing Grace." These were not people who went to church, not necessarily believe in God. And you had all these people singing, everybody from Elvis to Judy Collins. And her recording began getting requested, and it ultimately went to number one on the pop charts, "Amazing Grace." When you run a survey of America's favorite hymns today, every year, number one, by far, "Amazing Grace." Why? It's because when you and I grow still, when we stop and get honest, we know it's our song. It's our song. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. I was blind, but now I see." We all understand it because we are there. And it's why Paul would say, as God has forgiven you, let's start by looking at ourselves. As God has forgiven you, now I call you to go forgive one another. It's where we begin, and it's what will set you free, which is the third thing. I believe that truly it is forgiveness that sets you free to be family. when you and I choose to live only with hatred and anger, we live with a life sentence. We put ourselves in prison and live in a life sentence. It's only when you and I choose to forgive that we set ourselves free. You may set the other person free who wronged you. It may or may not change them, but it will set you free. It changes you so that you can find joy and you can find a new beginning. Forgiveness is not easy. It is hard. But it's when we get honest with ourselves that we have stood in the need for forgiveness, that we are able to offer it to other people, and you find a new freedom to be family. You know, most of the time the things that we need to forgive are not so significant as a Leslie Van Houten. So often they're the things that were said or the snubs that were done or the way we were treated. And you know, as the years have gone by, one of the things that I now look at after doing this for 43 years, there were things years ago that I thought were big deal. Don't seem so big anymore. You get a different perspective on them. And how many times are those things that you and I have separated ourselves from family and friends and other things in life? You know, I wonder if this week might be a week that you decide there's someone you need to write, someone you need to call. You may or may not open the door. It may or may not change them, but it will change you, set you free. Or maybe it's simply a week where you draw a line in the dirt and say, I'm going to treat people where I work different. I'm going to treat people in my family different. They have hurt me. They have wronged me. But I'm not going to live with that. You'll be the one who's set free. It may or may not change them. You will be set free. It is only through forgiveness you have a chance to have long-term relationships. Only through forgiveness that you can have family. Only through forgiveness, Paul would say, will the church survive. You know, one of my favorite writers is Mitch Albom. What a great guy. Mitch Albom's now written so many books I've enjoyed. As you know, he is a sports writer. He is Jewish. And Mitch wrote a book a while back entitled Have a Little Faith. Fascinating story in his life. And it was a story about how one day he was given a speech. And when he was through with the speech, his rabbi, Rabbi Albert Lewis, came up to him and said, Mitch, will you do the eulogy at my funeral? And Mitch was so taken back. I mean, you see, the truth is, he'd grown up in the synagogue. He'd been bar mitzvahed. He'd become a cantor. He helped lead worship. He worked side by side with Rabbi Al. He had had a youth group when he was in college, but after college, he drifted away from the faith. It had been 20 years since he had been coming back to synagogue. He hadn't participated. God had been pushed into the far areas of his life. He had nothing to do with God or the synagogue. And suddenly here was the rabbi asking him, would you do my eulogy? He knew that Al must be dying, might happen sometime soon, and so he said, yes, I will do it. He immediately thought, I need to go see the rabbi. I got to catch up on what's happened in the last 20 years. Kind of find out what he wants to have done. What does he want to have said? And when he goes and he sits down and visits with the rabbi, what he discovers is the rabbi is very healthy and fine. He's not near death. And so it turns out that Mitch starts coming to visit with the rabbi about once a month, coming back into town, coming to see his parents, sitting down and visiting with the rabbi. No, the rabbi doesn't die for 8 more years. But because Mitch comes back and rekindles that friendship, and because they start talking about faith and they talk about God and they remember, Mitch comes back to faith. God becomes very important in his life again. He becomes that person of faith again. And he would even say, looking back, I now realize the old rabbi was just setting me up. He had a plan. And it worked. It got Mitch back into the faith community. But more than that, he did want him to do his eulogy. And 8 years later, one day, the rabbi suddenly had a stroke, and just a couple days later, he was gone. And it was finally time for Mitch to fulfill that responsibility he had been given and committed to. He had been working for 8 years. He had that eulogy written. And when it came, I mean, this rabbi had been a part of the congregation for 60 years. And you can only imagine, this place was packed. All these people turned out. And Mitch stood up and he gave the eulogy and he did a really good job. I read it. It was a beautiful tribute. And when he was through, he sat down and the cantor stood up to lead him in the last hymn. And suddenly, the grandson of the rabbi came forward up into the altar area and said, "Wait a minute, there's one more thing." And he plugged in a cassette tape and suddenly the voice over the speaker system said, "Hello, this is your past rabbi, Albert Lewis." Unbeknownst to anyone else in the family or anyone, only to the housekeeper and to the grandson, Albert had recorded what he wanted to have said at his funeral. And Mitch said, "I should have known he would trump me at the end." And you know, I really like that idea. You know, I like having the last word, and just in case this wonderful staff doesn't get it right at my funeral, I could set the record straight and I could get it out there. I'm thinking about this one. Al had it all recorded. The grandson came up, he plugged it in, and he said, "You know, I got two things I want to tell you. Everybody's been asking me all my ministry, do you really believe in God? Is there God?" Al had lived through two world wars, the Holocaust. His 5-year-old daughter had died suddenly. He had known incredible grief and pain. And he said, "The answer is yes. I'm happy to tell you, I now know there is a God. The answer is yes. The second question you've always been asking me is there really life after death? And now again, I can tell you the answer is yes, there is life after death. Only now I can't tell you all about it." And then he said, "What I want to leave you with is simply a thought. Don't let trivialities divide you. Love each other. Talk to each other. Forgive each other. Be family." Paul would say, "Forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive." It's the only way to be family, to be church. If somebody were to take a snapshot of you, would they see the nature of God? Would they see the spirit of forgiveness? It's in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Let each of us lift up our own silent prayer.